You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. Tonight, we continue our series on the rapid rise in the need for energy that is caused by the increase in data centers and computing power that's going to be needed for the development of artificial intelligence and advanced weapon systems, including those that will be launched into space. Yep, that's right, folks. Now, when you think about critical minerals, liquid natural gas and crude, and even the uranium that we would need for the mobile nuclear reactors we've already talked about, meaning reactors of any scale, you have to consider where these things are mined. As we learned about uranium, we're still getting that from the Russian Federation. Not a good look, but those are the facts. 20% of oil comes from outside the United States. 11% of that comes from KSA, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. 11% still comes out of the Russian Federation. 5.5% Canada, it's a pretty safe place. 5% China, 4.2% Iraq, 4% UAE, 3% Iran. And then we have to deal with cobalt, lithium, nickel, and other rare earths, much of which comes from inside China. Now, cobalt apparently is in very, very high quantities in the ground in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And as you have probably heard in the news, particularly if you follow financial news, both Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates are wandering into the DRC for the purpose of mining cobalt. Now, does this sound like risky business? That's because it is. So what risks are posed to individuals when they go to do business in countries like that? Or frankly, any country with a weak central government and warring factions. So our guest tonight is Kieran Ramsey. He is the chief investigative officer of Global Reach, a private company that deals with individuals wrongfully held or taken hostage around the world. Kieran is a former director of the FBI's Hostage Recovery Fusion Cell and the former special agent in charge of the Portland Field Office. And upon his retirement, he was, I think, an AD, assistant director. So, Kieran, I'm really glad you're here tonight. You're like a good expert to have on the topic of safety to private companies going into, my mother had an expression, these godforsaken places where anything could happen. So why don't we talk about that? There are going to be some physical risks, at the very least, posed to people working in the energy sector in these countries. What do you think? What should they know about?
Absolutely. And first off, thanks so much for having me. It's a real privilege to be with you tonight. First off, for any of these countries, when you're talking about either U.S. companies or multinational energy sector companies going into these countries, it's really about the risk and reliability of doing business there. That's really what it comes down to when you think about it. So let's, though, talk about some terminology that I want to get out of the way first so we can make sure we have an understanding of where the conversation might take us, which generally in my line of work is down dark holes of bad things happening, unfortunately. So first, we have what we refer to as kidnappings or kidnappings for ransom. Generally, those are committed by criminal groups, organized criminal groups. Then we have hostage taking. Under U.S. federal law, that's recognized as a terrorist group taking a hostage for some kind of concession. And then last but not least, we have wrongful detentions, also known as unlawful detentions, also known as unjust detentions, arbitrary detentions. There's a lot of different terminology that's used. But for the U.S. government's purposes, in my prior role, and even in what I do now, we talk in terms of wrongful detentions, and those are committed by foreign governments. So for that list of countries that you just went down, where we get oil from these places and cobalt's coming from the DRC and all these minerals that are now supercharging our race in AI, hypersonics, and just electric cars, let's say. But for all of those countries, many of those, unfortunately, are fully leveraging what we call hostage diplomacy. It's a horrible term, unfortunately, and it's something that is greatly expanded. It goes back to the ancient times where it wasn't uncommon for rival countries to kidnap or take one of their diplomats and hold them until some concession was granted. But put in the current context, hostage diplomacy has become a strategic foreign policy tool of many of the countries that you just went down that list with. Let's just start from the top. We can go Russia, China, Iran. Russia is estimated to have between 9 and 10 Americans that are wrongfully detained or unlawfully detained, arbitrarily detained. Now, I'm not going to say any of them are energy sector employees. I don't believe any of them are, to my knowledge, at least. But certainly the only way they're coming out of this situation is if there is some kind of diplomatic agreement or some kind of diplomatic negotiation that results in their release. And oftentimes for Russia, it generally results in some kind of Russian citizen who has been convicted in a U.S. federal court being released in exchange, or perhaps some other kind of foreign policy concession. But generally, it's been a, what we weren't used to be able to say, it's usually been a swap. We were never allowed to say swap in the U.S. government before, but it's just becoming so commonplace. Now, the fact is, even though those that are in these horrible situations right now are not energy sector employees, Russia has long sought to falsely charge Americans with espionage charges. And it is really agnostic of whatever profession they happen to be in. Now, I'll tell you of note, generally speaking, in these recent years, we've seen actually a lot of number of American veterans and journalists falsely charged with some kind of espionage situation in Russia, and then again go into this wrongful detention situation. And the point I guess I'm trying to make with Russia is to think that they wouldn't do the same with an energy sector employee for whatever reason is naive. Now, the same can be said to a certain extent for China. At the end of last year, we saw three Americans released under a diplomatic arrangement that was bartered out by the previous administration. And they were thankfully released from their wrongful detention. But again, to think that China wouldn't seek to leverage something against an energy sector employee of a U.S. company or some kind of multinational company of a U.S. citizen, again, I think is wishful thinking. Let's shift to Iran. Unfortunately, we know Iran has a very long history of hostage diplomacy, if not out-and-out hostage taking. As a veteran of the FBI, I can simply say the name Bob Levinson. Bob Levinson is a name that is revered in the Department of Justice and the FBI and the intelligence community because, sadly, he had this fantastic career and then went to Kish Island off the coast of Iran and was taken into custody in 2007 and then disappeared by the Iranian regime. Again, sadly, the family agreed with the U.S. government assessment that he had likely perished while he was in captivity back in 2020. But the fact is, Iran has a long history of this. And even though we don't have necessarily a legitimate energy sector presence from the U.S. there in Iran, that could change if there is ever a nuclear negotiation. And it's not to say that multinational companies aren't sending people into Iran for that. Now, let me add one more country to the list that you didn't actually mention that's problematic, and it's Venezuela. The U.S. government is actively in pursuit of some kind of energy deal with Venezuela. I don't necessarily know the details. I'm not an energy expert or anything. But the fact is, just last month, the U.S. State Department issued a very stark warning to any American travelers to avoid Venezuela and even went so far as to avoid third countries and the border area with that country and Venezuela for the extreme risk of kidnapping, wrongful detention, and even torture. So that shows you kind of the playing field that we're on when we talk about the threats that are posed to Americans, that are posed to employees of energy sector companies. Now, as it were, the U.S. government and any number of non-governmental organizations out there do a lot of analysis on this threat and keep track of the numbers and everything and try and really make sure that they are illuminating the risks to American global travelers, of U.S. multinational corporations. In fact, later this week, the Center for Strategic and International Studies is due out with their report on combating state hostage taking and wrongful detention. So bottom line, companies need to be very well informed in terms of the geopolitical situation of just one segment of things, but also their employees and American global travelers generally need to be better informed travelers as they seek to go around the world for whatever the reason, be it for employment in the energy sector or because they're adventure travelers.
Yeah, and I mean, these are the same countries that sort of have a history of asymmetrical practices. China less so, I think, because they now have such military might. But it's very interesting listening to you talk about that. And of course, Venezuela is a petrostate. They can cast themselves in any way that they want. But the naked truth is that's a big part of their GDP. And I do believe, and I'll have to look at this again, but I think that there are other items that are used in long-term batteries, like vehicle batteries, that they also have inside. You mentioned the tri-border region where Venezuela connects with other countries. And I believe those items are found even up there. I know there are copper mines. And in a lot of South America, they have not just coal, but coal with the highest BTU in the country, which makes it even more attractive. So we talk a lot about physical security. And I guess because I've spent some time overseas, and I know you have been in much more dangerous situations than I have, you do think a lot about physical security. But the other thing that you have to think about is other kinds of security, right? There are secondary risks, not just to individuals, but also to companies in terms of the things that could go wrong that may boomerang and have an impact back at home and maybe on things like return on investment, you know, things that could end up in necessary disclosures to shareholders. Do you want to talk a little bit about what some of those secondary risks might be?
Sure. Just like all these countries have this risk of hostage taking, kidnapping, or wrongful detention, as it were, all of these countries, they are also very active in the economic espionage space, right? Which is targeting the crown jewels of whatever the company is. And if it's an energy sector company, certainly that. So let's take the PRC government. They have long been accused of using various methods, numerous methods, to especially include exploiting commercial entities to obtain U.S. technology and trade secrets. And in fact, a significant portion, as you and I both know, of economic espionage prosecutions in the U.S. are involving the PRC's theft of intellectual property or trade secrets and the resulting benefits to China's industrial sector. It's just a fact. We've seen it, unfortunately, over these last 20 years, just exponentially increase across the entire country and really across almost every sector we can think of, be it energy or otherwise. And there are unfortunately too many examples to give. I recall as an FBI agent, I was in Boston for years. And one of the biggest examples we used to use to highlight the importance for companies to pay attention was a wind turbine manufacturer based in Massachusetts that was literally put out of business because they were able to get the IP secrets of that company and ultimately outcompete it on the world stage, and it shut it down. And that's just one of 1,000 examples that we could go into. So really, all the private sector companies, and I know we're talking specific to energy, they have to know, okay, what are their crown jewels? And every specific company knows what its crown jewels are. They need to know how they're protecting those. And they need to be aware of the fact that economic espionage efforts are going to be targeting them all the time in every sphere possible. We talk a lot today about cyber intrusions and cyber theft and everything. Huge, huge attack surface area that is absolutely there. But that's not to say that they're not going to try and exploit some, you know, for an energy sector company, somebody's personal phone or personal laptop as they enter the country or as they're in the country. There are huge risks to these companies that they have to be constantly aware of. The fact that economic espionage efforts targeting their employees and their crown jewels are going to continue. And it's going to continue to be up to each company to then determine the risk and reliability of doing business in that country, as I've stated a couple of times before.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of these companies are transnational in terms of their operations and scope. And nobody travels without a laptop. I mean, nobody does it. You show up and then you hand it over to airport security, who you think is airport security. You pick it up on the other side, or you don't, and it's gone for longer. It just isn't there anymore when you go to retrieve it. Or you maybe make the mistake of logging into the Wi-Fi available in the hotel room. You're placing a lot of things at risk. And if you don't have everything sort of compartmentalized and firewalled so nobody can get to anything that would be IP, then, you know, maybe you need to revisit your practices would be, I guess, one thought that I would have. We recently spoke to a really brilliant guy named Paul Nantulia, and he wrote a study on African ports. And just the big takeaway from that, Kieran, is that China has built port infrastructure that really is dual use, military and commerce. I mean, it's more or less encircling the entire African continent with gaps here and there. But obviously, we went over the list of critical minerals that are found in Africa, and it's very high. And many of them are things that we need in our advanced weapon system. And of course, you know, there are big mining companies, you know, the Rio Tintos of the world and all of that. But there are also an enormous number of infrastructure projects, including in the energy sector, that are directed by China. Now, people are going into Africa right now. DRC is just one example. What are the challenges, do you think, that are posed by projects in Africa? And what do you think about the presence of so much Chinese influence, assuming everywhere you go in Africa right now, they're building roads, they're building infrastructure, they're teaching people Mandarin, you know, it's sort of metastasized throughout the continent. What are your thoughts, sort of Africa focused, knowing that that really is the font of a lot of what's needed in our stuff?
Without a doubt. And I've seen it firsthand myself. You know, I was assigned as the legal attaché for the FBI in Cairo, Egypt, a number of years ago. And I covered Libya and Sudan from Egypt regionally and happened to travel across the continent as a result of that assignment. And you could see, visibly, easily see the China presence on the continent. And you watched it increase year over year. So when we think about PRC investments in Africa, particularly through their Belt and Road Initiative, right? It's obviously significantly increased not only its presence, but its influence on the continent and almost everywhere, which can present many challenges to U.S. companies and multinational companies. China, in fact, it's increased its investment on the continent from like millions of dollars annually to billions of dollars annually in less than 20 years. I mean, that's how much they've ramped up through their generally under the big umbrella of the Belt and Road Initiative. And the increasing dominance resulting from that shows an increasing presence and dominance of PRC standards. You mentioned language just by one example, but PRC standards across the board, PRC technologies, which all can come together and can not only perhaps restrict market access to U.S. companies and multinational companies, but certainly also feeds into that topic we just spoke about before, economic espionage on the continent. Secondarily, when we think about this challenge, the PRC's investments in Africa have caused concerns of things like debt trapping, economic dependence, and prioritization of China interests over local interests across the continent. We hear these stories in the news all the time, in fact. And I think there is also the risk, though, that relates to that. And that is the risk of a negative perception and impact against an international, let's say, energy company, a multinational energy sector company in this regard, that's on the continent, wherein that anger and frustration that really has to do with whatever the PRC effort is, the PRC agency is, getting shifted for some reason to the multinational instead. And all of a sudden, you have a physical security risk against that multinational security because of the PRC effort that's ongoing, probably in close proximity. Oftentimes, we see that competing mining operations, competing drilling operations, what have you. And it's not to say that they're not even trying to buy those out and be able to control an entire region. But when you see that overall effort that they have and the ability to then, well, they have an entire intelligence apparatus themselves at their full disposal as the PRC government, as a PRC entity, to then, okay, well, we need to get rid of this multinational company that's taking market share and just, we don't want them here anymore. So let's do something locally to impact their operations. We've seen that. It's a reality and it's something that people have to be cognizant of.
You know, I'm listening to you, and maybe because I've been watching the movie Mountainhead recently on Max, which I commend to everybody, although talk about dark. All I can say is I could see exactly what you're saying. So I could see a scenario where we've got a huge mining operation, get one of those, you know, good American guys who've got like an engineering degree from a state university, and they're just brilliant, and they've got this apparatus, and they're set up in suddenly a Facebook or TikTok campaign suggests that they're the problem and not the Chinese. And let me say, last week, Chinese did start calling in some of the debt in these countries, which I think is going to translate to they're just going to get full control over a lot of these critical minerals. But I could see a situation, because it happened in Ethiopia, where basically a war started on Facebook. There was like a false story that got picked up. It sounded like somebody's village got raided and people went into defense mode and it just deteriorated. But I could also see a scenario where something was done or manipulated by the Chinese, as a result of which American lives and intellectual property were suddenly at risk, as was the commodity that's being mined. We all depend on communication, satellite, internet. What kind of risks are posed to communications with, you know, the mothership back in the United States, or even the lawyers or the private security that you may need, whatever it is? What happens to communication? Aren't communications systems at risk in this doomsday scenario, or not doomsday, or realistic scenario?
Absolutely. So communication systems can always be a target of first or last resort for any adversary. We can set that stage right away. But let's back up for a sec, because I think you gave a great segue to this, that we see this added issue of security risks being morphed because of this great power competition, right? And especially on the African continent. Traditional security risks were often viewed as perhaps beginning something as like an unaddressed community concern. And it metastasizes from a community complaint to perhaps a local protest, to all of a sudden jumping forward to sabotage, vandalism, threats to local employees, and a robust need for a significant security response if it wasn't already in place and able to handle what I would tell you would be then morphing into a novel crisis versus, you know, not that there's a routine crisis. So for companies facing not only that traditional concern perhaps that they have, and we've seen this example, right, across various regions and sectors where something perhaps as simple as a water issue morphs into a major battle between community X and whatever region, village, where have you, against big, bad, multinational corporation X. But then it just explodes onto the scene. So we have that traditional thing, but now we have this economic espionage and the great power competition and IP theft and all of these other things. So that really requires the security mindset, the security strategy needs to incorporate really a lot of other things. You know, traditionally, it should include community engagement, community relations, maybe even human rights standards training for your personnel that are perhaps enforcing the security on the scene. But now we've got to make it even more holistic. So let's take the example of even this year, setting aside the PRC threat, but let's just go back to normal kidnappings. Not that kidnappings should be normal or we should minimize them or the trauma that they inflict. But even earlier this year, we saw a spate of increased kidnappings driven by the Islamic State, of all things, inspired Islamic State groups or affiliated groups, which in past was perhaps considered like opportunistic banditry, fairly unsophisticated, fairly low level. Well, now that's evolved into a very sophisticated criminal enterprise that we saw evolve over the 20-aughts from groups in like Mali and Niger, with other groups on the other side of the continent, with Boko Haram and everything. And they became so sophisticated that there was established pricing models for kidnaps for ransom. There was sophistication and negotiation engagements. There was complexities across border areas, which roped in multiple countries being forced to not only cooperate with each other, but then calling in post-colonial powers, such as the U.S. in some instances, but certainly France got dragged into a lot of these things. Mm. So the dynamics on the ground became so complex. We have to understand the evolution is crucial for a complementary risk management strategy and risk analysis strategy when we think about these things. The combination of these traditional vulnerabilities, such as a remote area for where the operation is, combined with very valuable corporate assets, which need to go beyond simply thinking about, okay, what is it and where is it that we're trying to extract from the ground here? And then add to that the local dynamics on the ground and the geopolitics of it all. Yeah. It becomes an entire soup. And we continue to see the fact that, It could start with attacking a communication system so that there is interrupted ability to get direct guidance from some multinational corporate headquarters, or maybe even the U.S. government, so that that call for help can't happen when things start to devolve or degrade in terms of just a general security situation that they're looking at.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.